What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy.
People like me, Paddy, from the outside looking in, like I'd have learned way more off watching the likes of Bernard Brogan than I'd have learned off Jeremy Connolly and David Clifford, because them boys are freak shows.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
The OTB Podcast Network with GetsetGo. Quick start car insurance that's ready when you are. Sort your policy anytime online at GetsetGo.ie.
The Football Show on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power's Save Our Game. Donating 10k to Irish football for every goal England score the Euros. Gamble responsibly. GamblingCare.ie.
I'm prepared to do anything I can.
Well, do it then.
Country again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
Oh, it wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
All right, you're welcome along to Thursday's Football Show. Nathan with you for the next hour. Dan McDonnell is with us. Good evening, Dan.
Evening, Nathan.
We're on the eve of Euro 2020. Part of me was thinking, goddamn COVID, where would we be in the world right now? But actually, we would just be right here in Dublin, looking ahead potentially to Slovakia against Poland or something like that. So I'm not sure what I was getting excited about.
If you want to take that point, it would have been over 12 months ago.
Exactly. So we'd just be having a quiet summer.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you know, you want to take that theory all the way you want. But I have to say, as it's got, I wasn't sad about the Euros being taken away. Like, I'm going to Tallaght Stadium tomorrow. There's going to be 1,000 fans there. And I thought it was more important, and I still believe that it was more important to prioritise, you know, getting regular matchgoers here, you know, back to their sporting habits. I know obviously there's Leinster on tomorrow as well too, and there's other events being rolled out in the coming weeks. I did think that was more important than, you know, say accommodating people to watch Slovakia and Sweden or whatever.
Could we not have had both?
But as we get here now, you know, there is a small part of me, all right, that's thinking, you know, you feel a bit detached from this tournament in a way, particularly having covered quite a lot of the recent tournaments, you know, and the idea of having a couple of games here would be pretty cool. You would feel at least in some way you'd be part of it. But it wasn't important enough at the time when the decision was being made, it must be said. We're feeling a little bit more liberated now by everything that's going on. It wasn't an important battle to fight at the time. But obviously, it wouldn't be too bad to have a couple of games coming up to go to, I guess, for those who had tickets. And maybe that's a selfish media thing too.
Considering there was so much talk at the time around the venues and could they host games, it now feels as though that's almost been overlooked as part of this European Championship. It's only when you see Wales getting on their flight to Baku, you have to remind yourself, actually, this may be a factor during the tournament. A lot of these teams have quite a lot of travelling between matches, which they've never experienced before at a major tournament.
Yeah, and even speaking to a couple of media in the UK and stuff, and I think there's even, not that important, but even with various variants that are sort of just concerns at the moment, like they've been a bit stricter in terms of people going from country to country in terms of maybe some media and but also support staff. And it just reminds you that there's a precarious aspect to this. You see the Spanish situation at the moment with a few cases and what's going on there. That, yeah, like it is. I mean, look at it. Ultimately, this is still a mad format, this competition. And really, it's hard to think of anything less suited to a pandemic, you know, than a 11-nation tournament as it is now. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, the idea to start with, I wasn't mad in it. But at this moment, it's sort of, there's still a certain madness to it. As much as they've got to the starting line, which I must admit at various times it looked, the idea of it being in one country was being actively spoken about as a real live plan. You know, someone like Russia would take it on, or even, you know, Boris would take it on. So it's sort of remarkable in a way that they've got to where they are. But you know, it just feels like, yeah, it feels like, you know, that there's going to be stories during it of a COVID nature. It almost feels inevitable.
It does feel as though as well that international football is far more affected by the lack of supporters than the club game is, that particularly maybe at that highest level of Premier League, La Liga, Serie A, where there is such a high technical quality of all the players that we now know really that international football isn't the pinnacle. Like, international football isn't where the Champions League is in terms of on the pitch, off the pitch for supporters, for so many, it still means as much. And international football is that little bit slower at times than club games, and without the crowd there, actually, there's a lot of football on over the next 2 weeks, and I'm very excited about watching it. Maybe I shouldn't be as excited about some of these games as I am.
Yeah, no, I know what you're saying. I mean, look, I'm still a big lover of international football in terms of there's still a certain authenticity about it without being too, misty-eyed over the whole thing, because obviously, you can still recruit players and money, still counts, and there's a certain, the strongest will survive to some degree. But there's factors that can't be controlled in the same way that, you can't have a Man City or a PSG sort of style jump to prominence within it. And also, I think, your football point is completely correct. I think it's very hard to argue with the fact that, the highest level of football is the knockout stages of the Champions League, but there is there's a certain prestige that comes with the major tournament. I think the World Cup to me is still above everything else. But even with the Euros, there is, you saw Ronaldo, for example, at the last one, and what it meant to him, because even at Madrid, he has been certain, he would have been surrounded by superstars all the time, and they would buy in something. But the fact that it meant a lot to him, personally, as much as anything, working with a team that maybe, now listen, Portugal are still star-studded, but that 2016 team actually wasn't as good as maybe their current one. And that there is something that you have to almost throw these personalities together and just make it work. And what you share in common is where you're from, but sometimes they mightn't share a huge amount more in common. And there's a great sporting challenge in trying to, even trying to guess the teams that we might talk about England and who they're going to play. And there is something about it that I still really enjoy, that people will complain about international football sometimes, but I think, I just think that there can be a certain unpredictable aspect to areas of the major tournament that are great, that there's more romance to it than we will find in the club game now at certain levels. And to go back to your point, your initial starting point, but definitely you need the colour and the fans and everything to go with it. That is a massive part. And what we have here, and this is still going to be a sort of diluted version of that in this tournament, because obviously a certain number of teams are going to have frenzied home support behind them. Others will not, and they won't have the same volume of, say, travelling fans, that sort of festival vibe that would be created in a regular tournament. So there will be a couple of games that I think will have a slightly surreal, subdued potentially atmosphere. But the contrast to that is you have, Scotland at home and Hungary at home and obviously the Wembley games, and there's quite a few other teams with similar situations. Well, it's going to be an amazing actually, but almost like NBA style, with sort of no real away support as such. I think there's going to be some away support in times based on, depending on geographical situations, but not that, not that sort of travel vibe that you would associate with it. So it's going to be a bit different, but I think we'll all get into it. I think we will.
Yeah, I have a feeling we will. We'll come back to the Euros in a minute and look ahead to the opening weekend. We should put the cap on the week for Ireland. It feels as though this week has brought a sense of calm back to the camp that got the job done, got the win against Andorra. There was an improvement in performance against Hungary. Stephen Kenny learn a lot from the past 2 weeks?
I think so. I would have thought so. I mean, listen, the easy answer is that we'll find out in due course either way, and we might have a different discussion. But I think you're right about the sense of calm. I think it still feels at the moment that almost every Ireland game, there's a massive debate around Stephen Kenny around it. We just can't avoid it. It's and you will be in the sort of the epicenter of it, text messages, feedback, comments, that what comes through. Every match, it's either a pro Kenny or an anti Kenny, and there's a real, that it's just everything is centered around that discussion, and not as much just general discussion about how the team is evolving without always going back to where the manager stands and that. And listen, from the media perspective, we have to accept some responsibility for that, because we're writing pieces or producing pieces that are very much centered around that. And I think like what that reflects as much as anything is that he still doesn't have defeat under the table yet, you know, in the sense that he doesn't have, like, you know, you don't have that around Jurgen Klopp after every Liverpool game. You just debate his team and what's going on with them. Like, he doesn't have that credit in the bank.
How does he get past that? Because I got the sense watching those two matches and the fallout and everything around it that, particularly because of the Luxembourg defeat, that the stain of that is going to last a long time. And I'm not sure how he ever gets past that unless results dramatically turn, which is going to be difficult with the group of players that are there at the moment.
Yeah, listen, my view on this, and probably, you know, at the start of the year, my view is I thought he would be fine in terms of having his probably deal extended once he didn't have a Macedonia-style, Cyprus-style defeat. And unfortunately, he's now had that defeat against Luxembourg that is a stick to beat him with. So to almost offset that, I think he probably does need to produce some kind of landmark result in the autumn in some shape or form. In reality, like, the campaign is going to end with Ireland not qualifying. I wish that wasn't the case. I desperately wish that wasn't the case. It's very hard to see that not, you know, being a natural conclusion. So I think there's two things that would happen. Like, one is to just get that landmark result somewhere. And that was probably taking points off Portugal or, you know, beating Serbia at home. Or I suppose the other thing is, like, you talk about the fan angle and the stadiums opening up, that if when the stadiums open, you know, when the Aviva hopefully opens up in September, you have an Azerbaijan game at home, and then there's a Serbia game after that, following on quickly. I think in October they play Qatar, and then in November there'll be Portugal, in terms of just the home games alone. And if there was a sense, well, actually, there's enough people going that are actually buying into this, and he can win a couple of those games, particularly winning the games you should win with a degree of style, well, then maybe that sort of brings a sense of calm too in some way. But you sort of feel like there needs to be a moment, you know, a game that produces a sort of an outpouring of, like, celebration of something. Because I think there is still, I do think that people would watch the other night, like I've said this, like, I don't think you could watch the game on Tuesday and say, well, this is a team in crisis, like, that you know, this is going nowhere. I don't think you could say that. But clearly, to win over as people who will never forget Luxembourg, I think that there is a sense of needing to do something against a stronger team, that really you can make that as a point in the road and say, well, this is a marker for progress.
Yeah.
And let's go on from here.
What is his contract situation? Is it up at the end of this campaign? It's simple as that?
Yeah, no, it is. So that's basically the situation. And I do think that people are conscious of it becoming a thing. Like, we don't have too much example of, like, Irish managers, and we're reflecting on the Delaney era FAI here, where, you know, contracts would happen in weird ways at weird times. You know, where they even signed at all, that was the big thing with Martin O'Neill, wasn't
well,
it?
Well, the last European Championship in Versailles, they said he had signed it, but when he was asked, he signed it, he was still waiting to do it.
Yeah, so things were done in a slightly, I don't know if we can talk about FAI contract policy, but so in the Delaney years, I'm not even sure what we can go back to, but I suppose the start of the Delaney years was Brian Kerr's situation, where you had a situation where, and I was only thinking about this the other day, like, you know, like, Brian Kerr played a game against France in September, which was, like, I'm sure you remember the game, like, you know, with the sort of the deflected goal, and that was a massive game. You know, a huge game, and Ireland were so close to being, if that game had gone either way, like, Ireland could have qualified for a World Cup. And yet 2 months later, or a month later, he was basically gone. And all that autumn, before every match, the question is, well, are you worried about your contract? Or to every FAI person, what's the story with your contract? And again, this is classic, like, well, we will ask those questions and have those debates and discussions. And as much as you would say, well, let's all leave that till November and let's talk about it then, that's not how the news cycle works. That's not how it all pans out. So as a result, I do think that there probably are people in the FAI that would like to have, if he is to be retained, I think would like to have clarity sooner. And I honestly think if results had gone better to this point, I wouldn't have been shocked if they'd extended it, but clearly that they need to see more evidence, you know. And there's been changes at board level, like Paddy Bonner's on the board now, independent director, you know, there's another director, Gary Tuig, has come in. So, like, it's a board decision ultimately, and there's a CEO who's getting his feet under the table as well. Jonathan Hill. So at some stage, they're going to have like discussions about this. And I think like the best case for everyone in terms of like stability would be if like September went really well, you know. And I think then it might be a situation where, you know, he's in line for discussions about an extension. But I think, to be fair, you know, until that moment happens, you know, it's very likely it could run until November and the end of the campaign, and you're left having a discussion and a review then.
A lot of the issues that he has faced over the last year are going to remain come September with players playing time for their clubs. Now, maybe it's not as big an issue on the 1st of September against Portugal, where the league is only back a couple of weeks. The Portuguese players are returning late to pre-season and everyone's at a similar level of fitness and they won't have had a huge amount of game time for their clubs anyways. But a lot of these younger players, we don't know where Troy Parrott and Adam Eder are going to be at the start of next season. They may well be in those days trying to get a transfer sorted or a loan move sorted. You were writing today about how he should go about picking that team, and does he need to almost start parking where they are at club level and the league that they're playing in, and pick a team actually that he wants to pick? So pick on what he is seeing in training more than maybe what they're doing with their clubs.
Yeah, I listen, that was what I was writing today. And obviously, listen, clearly, you know, if someone's not playing at all for their club, well, then that's obviously going to impact your thinking. But I certainly think that, like, I just thought the performance on Tuesday, it was just quite structured in terms of how, you know, how they played. And while I'm very wary of getting, you know, reading too much into June friendlies and, you know, Hungary are playing, you know, a major tournament in a week's time and, you know, not getting too caught up in it. But I think you have a situation where after 13 games now, like, there's obviously patterns emerging. And even listening to Stephen Kenny speaking himself, like, you know, he spoke a big thing last week with the lack of pace, for example, in his ranks, you know, and yet he spoke about someone like Chidozie Ogbeni, who's unbelievably quick, you know. And, you know, Daryl Horgan, I referenced in the piece today in particular, and Ogbeni are both on their way to League One by the looks of it, you know, unless there's moves that come their way in the summer, where Horgan at Wickham and Ogbeni at Rotherham. But Daryl Horgan, I think you watched the Ireland games, and every game he's come on or he's started in, he seems to make an impact in some way. And, like, it may, you know, it maybe if you were to list, like, the top Irish players from 1 to 11, then, without trying to put them out in a starting formation, you know, you might find that we are strong in particular areas, like our goalkeepers at the moment are, you know, we're stacked with them. But there's a real issue with, like, creativity, and there's a real issue with sort of, I think, pace in terms of the counter, particularly the way he wants to play sometimes. And these are the areas of the pitch where they've struggled. And there has been times that I think we've seen in the last in the year where, in particular games, you know, he's had Jeff Hendrick playing as the number 10. Now, I think at times that's because he wanted Hendrick to press on and be aggressive and do a job. But I think, you know, at times they've had reasonable strength in certain areas, but no real innovation or creativity or that sort of change of pace. And I think maybe when it comes to the autumn, like, it may well be that you just say, well, Horgan is something, that player that makes things happen for us. Mm. Ogbeni can make things happen for us. Maybe someone like Jack Byrne, depending on the situation, he's a creative player, although I'm still not 100% sure if Kenny is 100% on the Jack Byrne express in terms of being a massive fan.
Is that a difficult thing to do, Dan? Is that a difficult thing to do, though, for Stephen Kenny, when results have gone the way they are and you need to keep the camp tight, in that including those players means probably not playing Jeff Hendrick, Robbie Brady, senior members, influential members of the squad who, for the harmony of the squad, you probably need to be giving game time to. Like, they are going to be looking at it. If Daryl Horgan is playing League One and they're remaining in the Premier League next season, are going to be looking around thinking, what's going on here?
No, I see your point, but I think it's about balance as well. It just may well be that, like, Hendrick, well, I think Kenny really likes Robbie Brady and just, you know, just can't
get him fit.
I think Brady would play him all the time. I think actually Kenny said it in a press conference, he'd play him all the time if he was fine. But I just think it's more a case of, you know, Hendrick, James McCarthy, you know, whatever his situation is, Conor Hourihan. It may well be that they're just going to have to compete for one or two positions, because that's where they're, you know, that's the area of the pitch where they can, you know, they're maybe best suited or can play a role. But actually, particularly if he's going with three in the, if he wants to persist with the three at the back, and then it's like that sort of 3-4-3 or 3-4-1-2, I think the identity of the front three is pretty important. And if you're playing that way, Like, you need them to be players who can, who are very efficient in those positions, you know, and that's where they're at their most effective. And I think, I'm not saying he hasn't been doing that, but I think at times, like, you kind of wonder, like, there was times across the year where I think he did make references to someone being in League One, and obviously, you know, it's not as good a level as, you know, the Championship and the Premier League, and we'd love to have 11 Premier League players, but I just think it's a case of now, after 13 games, you should be able to see, well, who actually offers something different in this team? You know, it's like they can be the game breakers for Ireland, and they can sort of make things happen. But it's a difficult one because, you know, again, like all the time, if you suddenly have a situation where someone's playing regularly in the Premier League and they're not in the Irish starting team, that would be a stick to beat you with. Like, I made the point in the piece today, like Kieran Clark is probably going to play. Like, Kieran Clark had a very good season for Newcastle, like one of the few Irish players you could say had a good season. But Darragh O'Shea might well be just better suited to the left of the back three in that role in terms of the skill set that he offers. And he's going to be playing at a lower level next season. But O'Shea's probably a better fit. And I think eventually at some stage, Stephen Kenny needs a settled side,
yeah,
some kind of settled, structured side. And some people are going to be on the outside of that, that first 11. I mean, I think it was Owen Cowser referenced in a piece today that in 13 games, only two players have been available for every squad. For every 13 games, there's been so much chopping and changing, and I think maybe after a training camp for 10 days, 2 weeks, I just thought they looked a little bit more sure of themselves in where they stand, and I think that has to be some kind of template going forward into the autumn.
Yeah, it does look as though they are still together as a group. Now, I say that we're in a position where you don't get to see the players, you can't make massive judgments on them as they walk past you and ignore you in a mix zone as to what that means for the mood within the camp, and are they unhappy about not playing in a game. I did think from the off that Kenny was fortunate that he had senior players like Seamus Coleman, James McLean, Shane Duffy, and I put this some in the press conference, of they do seem like the perfect people for him in this position to have as the senior internationals. Like Coleman going out there as captain despite being injured, saying I'm going to go to that training camp, maybe even just to keep a lid on everything, that if there was any questions and frustrations within the squad, it's not really the sort of thing Seamus Coleman gets on board with. And it's been a big boost for Kenny in a way, publicly anyways, that nothing's been coming out of the squad.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, listen, obviously we had November and everything that went on around the Wembley game and the video. And certainly, like, there was some stuff going, and I don't even want to go down this road again, but there was like some stuff that was, I suppose, reported around that time, or suggestions being put out that time, putting, you know, sort of affixing opinions to senior players that I don't think corresponded with the feelings of those players. And certainly that seems to have, things seem to have tightened up maybe since then. You know, it seems like things have been a bit more stable. I think Anthony Barry's been a very popular appointment as a coach, it would appear, and certainly there seems to have been, you know, there doesn't seem to be sort of negative reports standing out there. Like, you know, even Shane Duffy speaking the other night, I think there's been an attempt at times to suggest that Kenny's dropping of Shane Duffy was some kind of an affront to Shane Duffy, or that this was a potential thing, and Duffy has made it perfectly clear that he's been in contact with Kenny all along, and he completely understands. He was almost grateful that he picked him for any game rather than being having his nose put out of joint that he was dropped for one. So I think certainly, as you mentioned, Coleman came out to do his bit, even though he was never going to play in Hungary, apparently. And, you know, Duffy, James McLean, they are like probably the senior, the core senior members of this group now. There'd be a couple of others who haven't been there. I suppose Randall's been around for a while, and I suppose Hendrick and Robbie Brady, as you mentioned, like James McCarthy. But I mean, a lot of them, like some of them, haven't been, you know, around for injuries and various reasons. So I think, like, yeah, I think the influential voices in the dressing room do seem to be on the same hymn sheet at the moment, and they're on board. And I think, like, again, sometimes how we talk about this, we always talk about it as though, you know, and this is possibly an issue, you know, that we are always talking about it as though that Kenny has to win the players over. This has always been a thing from the start. He always has to win them over. And it's even like, you know, we're talking about players backing him, and that even is part of the defeat not being under the table fully line of discussion. You know, that we're in that zone a small bit still, but there does seem to be no sense of like massive discord. Or I think that's probably why it was good to have a camp away, you know, for 10 days with no COVID issues and the tight bubbles, like, because that stuff was draining for people. You've had people on the show talking about it. I've, you know, had discussions with people, like, it was the camps weren't enjoyable. Like, there was just too much going on. And you know, when you're coming away to play for Ireland and you're in a hotel as it is and away from families and all of that, like, it can be difficult enough. Like, people always talk about the Irish camp being enjoyable, but it wasn't enjoyable for people.
No. And no trips to Gibney's anymore.
No, all that stuff is gone. And I think, you know, Kenny spoke about trying to, you know, like, I think they had a few games of golf when they were away, or players could do whatever they wanted, just to try and normalize things a small bit. And even, like, you have to, the whole backroom staff was changed, which is another thing that is contentious in a way. But there's a lot of people there just, you know, they wouldn't have known each other, you know? And that has been another part of the transition process that goes beyond the football stuff that we see.
Yeah, like any workplace, a good working night out can settle a lot of differences very quickly, for good or bad, I guess. Yeah. All our football and off the ball is with Paddy Power Save Our Game, donating £10,000 to Irish football for every goal England score at the Euros. For information on responsible gambling, visit gamblingcare.ie. So how many goals will England score is the question. I'll contradict myself on England, Dan, in that I think England are in a far stronger position than they were a year ago in terms of the talent available to Gareth Southgate. But I was more confident a year ago of them doing something because he seemed to know what his starting 11 was. He would have had Kane, Rashford, Sterling all playing real good football at that stage. Henderson was fit. They seemed to have an 11 in mind for the game, whereas now he has so many options. It seems remarkable he's going into a huge game, a repeat of a World Cup semi-final at the weekend against Croatia. And there's maybe 8-9 positions where it's still up for debate who he's going to pick.
Yeah, and, like, interesting reading some of the press stuff in England this week, and, like, some reporters would be well enough sourced. There was Mike McGrath, I think it was, in the Telegraph, you know, talking about sort of options they were looking at for the Croatia game. And I think, obviously, the Harry Maguire thing is very key to them defence. I know the attacking stuff is more interesting, but even just in terms of the defence, that they're on about maybe playing Luke Shaw in a back three, and, you know, just all sorts of permutations and combinations that they're talking about.
So they're talking about playing Kyle Walker, John Stones and Luke Shaw as a back three potentially.
Yeah, that was it.
With then two more full backs, Chilwell and
James or Trippier. I think that was the thing at the right side. And then it was going to be Rice and, I'm trying to think, was it Rice and Phillips or Rice and Mason Mount? Or I think, like, there's definitely a lot of permutations and discussion. Then the front three is the big debate. But obviously, if you change the system, then it might change, like, what you decide to do with the shape of your front three, you know, in some shape or form. So as you say, there's just a lot going on with the selection conundrum, and all their coverage over there is very much like everyone, you know, readers, like, send in your 11, or, you know, our pundits pick our 11. And there's, like, you know, normally, like, you know, I'm sure we've had it at times going to tournaments where there's one or two positions that you're debating, but this is like entire teams, you know, that actually, you know, like, I think people know Harry Kane will play, and people know Declan Rice will play, and
Stones,
you know,
and Pickford, and that's probably
Stones
about it.
Stones and Pickford, yeah, basically, you know, you'd imagine Walker will play in some in whatever system they play, you would think, but actually that's not even guaranteed by how good some of the other options are. So yeah, it's a bit of a weird one. And, like, the thing about England's tournament is, and this is the thing, you can talk about the competition, just, you know, look at who's the best team, but obviously you have to look at the permutations and the routes.
Well, they benefited in 2018 massively from being on the right side of the draw, where suddenly they found themselves in a position where an unexpected team, Croatia as it was, ended up in the final. This time round, it looks as though they're on the wrong side, and there's a big opportunity then for, we were talking earlier, you said Turkey, I'm saying Denmark, Austria, team like that, to go deep into this competition, maybe without having to beat one of the better teams.
Oh, definitely. Like, the teams that are in Group A and Group B, like the teams that we'll see out earlier, have a very interesting opportunity, you know. And even if a team like Italy didn't win their group, for example, it wouldn't be a disaster for them at all to be a runner-up in their group, because, you know, they potentially, you know, there's a passage there. And now, as you say, like, the underdog options, you'd definitely be looking at Groups A and B, and you can take your pick on who you think is the improver, you know, whether it's Turkey, as you mentioned, or Denmark. But whereas England's situation is basically, barring, you know, Hungary, you know, turning out to be, you know, a real surprise package, like, England are going to be playing, even if they win their group, which is a if, they're going to be playing a heavyweight team in the round of 16. And And if they don't win their group and they come second, I think they could play Spain, can't they? So, like, it's, you know, and I think for a team that's trying to find its way in the competition with its uncertainty, there's just that slight concern from their perspective that they just, this tournament, before they're getting their rhythm, they could be gone from it. You know, that's it. Before they find, because the thing about 2018, and from covering a lot of it, they sort of knew what they were. And, like, yes, you're right that the group, the pathway was favourable, but they had a degree of, like, structure within their setup that they hit on it in the tournament and it worked. I don't know, but they do have the home support as well, and that sort of Euro 96 vibe. And you never know, it could just ignite for them in another way and there's no turning back.
Yeah. We'll have any amount of coverage coming up and off the ball over the coming days and weeks. Euro 2020 show every day live at 11 a.m. with Shane Hannan. Clive Allen is going to be his guest on tomorrow's show. Dan, you're going to be back, I think, at the weekend on Saturday with John, looking ahead to the tournament. A bit more of a preview there. And obviously you'll have something to talk about then with Italy playing Turkey tomorrow night. Thanks as always, Dan. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Nathan.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power's Save Our Game. Donating at least 100,000 to Irish football via England Goals this summer. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.